The pressure is increasing on Puerto Rico's governor to step down. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Protesters flooded the streets in San Juan on Monday, and the Puerto Rican diaspora is also growing in its anger towards the island's leadership. We'll get an update from San Juan. Also, there is a new law in Florida that requires all 6th through 12th graders to receive a minimum of 5 hours of mental health instruction. We'll learn about the program that has Florida's First Lady as a strong proponent, and we'll learn more about what students need when it comes to mental health instruction. Finally,
and there in car number 12 is Randy Lanier. He will start this race in the center of the second row.
The Miami Herald has published a new podcast called Smoked. It looks at the story of Randy Lanier. He was once a big name in South Florida car racing. He was also a major marijuana smuggler. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. On Monday, the streets of San Juan, Puerto Rico were filled with protesters who were marching. They're continuing to put pressure on current Governor Ricardo Rosselló to step down from office. The anger from Puerto Ricans is reaching far beyond the island, as thousands here in the mainland are also demanding Rosselló to relinquish power. The movement is gaining momentum, driven by social media, not unlike what was seen during the Arab Spring. Earlier today, we spoke with Miami Herald reporter Bianca Padro Ocasio, who has been reporting on the protests from San Juan, and we started by discussing yesterday's massive showing in the city. Bianca, you're in Puerto Rico. Take us to what's been happening these last 24 hours. There was a massive march in San Juan yesterday with hundreds of thousands of people. Take us there. What happened?
We've been in about 11 days of consecutive protests. Yesterday, there was a massive march. It was the organizers called it a national strike. It was actually the second massive movement of people in the past, I'm going to say, 7 days. And it was mostly peaceful. There were hundreds of thousands of people blocking a major highway in San Juan. Malls were closed. You know, people were bringing in their cars, parking them on grassy areas, and just opening up their trunks. There were drinks, there was food, there was music, there was a stage. Daddy Yankee was there. So it was really just an environment that was really kind of family friendly, of celebration almost. But of course, behind all of that, there is a lot of anger. There's a lot of outrage at what's happening in the government of Puerto Rico. And they're all consistently calling for the resignation of Governor Ricardo Rosselló.
Let's talk about how this all started briefly. There were leaked messages. It was a chat that the governor was involved with top aides. Just remind us briefly what was going on in that chat and how it leaked.
It's still unknown who leaked it exactly, but there were about 12 members in this Telegram group chat. This leaked about, 8 days ago. It was published in the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico. These were 889 pages of the governor, Ricardo Rosselló, messaging and exchanging insults, sexist, homophobic comments, insulting political opponents. They were very profane and very explicit. These were members of his cabinet, his close allies, people who were not really in the government. And it's still unclear exactly, you know, the repercussions, if any, that this will have on his government. But what is clear is that it moved an entire island to really say, we're ashamed that this is the way that our government talks about us. There were several messages that were very violent. There was one where an aide to the governor said that he wanted to shoot up the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulín Cruz, who is Rosselló's political opponent. And Rosselló says, you would be doing me a favor. So, you know, just to give you a sense of how explicit these private messages were. And of course, there, aside from that, people are angry from the response to Hurricane Maria. There were some messages in the group where the government aides are making fun of the bodies that had been piling up at the medical examiner's office. This obviously created a lot of just anger and outrage at people who were waiting for their family members to be cleared from the backlog at the medical examiner's office.
Some people have been removed from their positions, right?
Two people resigned. It was the Secretary of State and Cristian Sobrino, who was the representative in the Fiscal Oversight Board from the government. There was another member of the chat who worked for the resident commissioner in Washington, Jennifer Gonzalez. He was also removed. And there have been several other resignations in the government of people who were or were not in the chat. But this is something that's kind of had a snowball effect.
And so, I mean, there's this call for the governor to step down, and he has said that he will not step down, but he did say he will not run again for office. But with all of these protests, as it just starts to pick up in this momentum, is there any sense that pressure is starting to get to him?
He has pretty much hunkered down and closed off the gates to La Fortaleza mansion. I believe I saw a tweet this morning that there was someone who saw him jogging on the beach in the beach town of Dorado. But he has pretty much not been seen since this whole thing started. He held two press conferences. The last one was last Tuesday, and yesterday he had a one-on-one interview with Fox News.
I've seen the protest. I've heard the people talk. I've had a process of introspection, and I did. I've made a decision. I'm not going to run. I'm not going to seek re-election, and that way I can focus on the job at hand.
It's hard to know whether this is getting to him, because all he's projecting is an image of business as usual in the government. He's tweeting from his account. The First Lady is tweeting about communities that she's been visiting and people that she's been meeting. And the truth is that on the ground, I've spoken to dozens of people. No one is buying it. No one believes that the government is functioning right now. People think that he's potentially making, moves to try and buy time. And the legislature has kind of signaled that they might initiate an impeachment process, but he's made it very clear that he will not resign.
I want to get to that in a moment. I want to come back to the protest a second, because you said that yesterday was very family friendly, but there have been instances where there were clashes between protesters and police. Are protests, though, becoming more dangerous?
Yesterday was at night, there was a confrontation with police. It was the third time since the protests began on July 10th that people have been tear gassed and police have shot rubber bullets at the crowd. The confrontations are definitely escalating. People are becoming less and less afraid. Yesterday, the crowd was so young. There were people who were 16, 17, who were there until, 2 or 3 in the morning. And police essentially just wanted to empty out the entire area of Old San Juan. And they kept throwing tear gas until the late hours.
Let's come back to, because you talked about the legislature has started even looking at the idea of impeachment. But first of all, who would take over if the governor stepped down or if he was removed?
The next person in line is the Secretary of State, which is a position that is vacant right now. After that, it would be the Secretary of the Justice Department on the island. So the idea is that if Rosselló was thinking of resigning, the government would have to fill the Secretary of State position, which is vacant.
A lot of people have come out in protest here in Miami and across the country. Last week in Miami, there was a protest in front of the Freedom Tower, and we heard from some South Florida residents. This is Joanna. She's 30, born and raised in Puerto Rico. She's lived in South Florida for 7 years.
As Puerto Ricans, like living in the island or outside of the island, we just feel the same way. We suffer the same things. We are reading the newspaper every day. We're following every article. We're following every situation that happens back in our country. Like if we were right there, because that's where our families are. That's where everybody that we have ever known is,
We also heard from Carlos. He's from Puerto Rico. He moved to Orlando in 2001, but he's been living in Miami now for 5 years.
What these people are doing here tonight is expressing their frustration It's not about the chat. It's just basically a lot of things that has been going on for decades and decades. And yeah, we made a lot of mistakes over the year, but enough is enough, you know. So I think there's a conscience already that we need to do better. We need to organize ourselves and say no to corruption in the first place.
You know, Bianca, you think about everything that's happening in San Juan, but do they know, do they hear about how it's moving people here in the United States?
Oh, people are very aware. And because Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens and they can travel back and forth and, you know, migrate back and forth between the island and the mainland, people have a lot of connections to diaspora communities throughout the mainland and throughout the world. There's been protests in Spain. There's been protests in the Dominican Republic, in some South American countries. So this is something that Puerto Ricans are very aware of, especially because after Hurricane Maria, Puerto Ricans experienced having international attention on the island, and it's kind of happening again. And something that I heard a lot from people is they feel like this is Hurricane Maria happening again. It's another disaster that the world is watching.
I'm talking with Bianca Padro Ocasio. She's a reporter for the Miami Herald. She's been in Puerto Rico covering the constant protesting on the island as people continue to crowd the streets of San Juan. If you are Puerto Rican, we want to hear from you. What are you thinking about what's happening back home on the island? Find us on social media at WLRN Sundial or email us at sundial@WLRNnews.org. Bianca, when we talk about Puerto Rico, of course, the conversation constantly comes back around to this question of statehood. Puerto Rico is a territory, of course. Has the conversation moved away from the topic of discussion because of everything that's happening, or because of everything that's happening, is that bringing this question back to the forefront?
I think that right now, this is something that a lot of residents had been saying for a long time, but there are some very immediate issues in Puerto Rico that kind of seem far from the question of statehood or independence or, you know, status quo. So I think right now advocates of statehood are worried in Washington because they feel like because the world is seeing the government in dysfunction and seeing all this corruption come out, there will be less of a will from U.S. Congress to support a movement for statehood. And this is something that I should say, the governor, Ricardo Rosello, this was essentially his only and main issue that he ran on, was I'm going to give Puerto Rico statehood. So, of course, there are people in his party who are worried that he is not the best face for the movement right now. And in fact, he resigned from the pro-statehood party presidency.
Social media has played such a big part of this, like it has for a lot of protests around the world. I mean, you got key celebrities who are playing a part. Ricky Martin, trap artist Bad Bunny, rapper Residente. How has social media really played a role in this? How are people using it?
It's crucial. I think yesterday the march was very reminiscent of a big march in the year 2000, where, you know, over 100,000 people were calling for the U.S. Navy to leave the island town of Vieques, where they were engaging in military testing, and they shut down the same highway. But the difference is that this time there were an estimated, you know, 400,000 people who attended. And a lot of this is due to social media. A lot of it is due to the fact that people can connect faster. They don't need a specific group to tell them where they have to meet and where to go. People just find out word of mouth. They think to themselves, like, I want to go out and I want to bring 10 people with me. So this is something that is very different and very, you know, clear to this time.
What's scheduled for tonight and the rest of the week?
It's very spontaneous, I have to say. Every day is very different. But what is certain is that in front of La Fortaleza, people are always gathering. And at 8 o'clock every night, people hold cacerolazos in certain neighborhoods, which is essentially banging on pots and pans in form of protest.
And you can follow Bianca Padro Ocasio and WLRN's reporting on the protests in San Juan at WLRN.org or follow us on social media at WLRN Sundial. By the way, you're listening to Lin-Manuel Miranda's Almost Like Praying, which includes Puerto Rican artists raising money for Hurricane Maria recovery. Well, still to come, Florida schools are now required to offer mental health instruction. More on that coming up on Sundial. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Last week, the Florida Board of Education approved a new requirement that all public schools need to teach at least 5 hours of mental health instruction beginning in sixth grade. The Department of Education's Commissioner Richard Corcoran said the new rule would be a lifesaver and, quote, is just the beginning. Anna Ceballos is a reporter with the News Service of Florida. She's joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Anna, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Valerie Barron. She's the operations director of the nonprofit organization HIP, based in Miami-Dade County. They offer student-to-student mental health counseling. Valerie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we've been hearing from you on social media about what you think these lessons should entail. We heard from MT Law Miami, who tweeted us, they should focus on how to recognize depression, where to get help, how avoidance behavior makes it worse, destigmatizing, and self-medication. You can also share your thoughts on our social media on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Anna, let me start with you. What was the impetus behind the creation of this new program? Again, all 6th through 12th graders now have to have at least 5 hours of mental health instruction. Where did that come from?
Well, we started seeing the rule development about, I think it was in late June, the first time that we saw the Department of Education show interest in requiring a minimum amount of time that students should be learning about mental health. But it was during the meeting at the State Board of Education meeting that we realized that how much of a strong hand the First Lady had on this specific proposal. Richard Corcoran, who's the Education Commissioner, was, you know, pointing at her as like the main, basically the brainchild of the brainchild of the First Lady.
Yeah, First Lady Casey DeSantis. But how much of the tragedy of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas played a part in this?
Well, that was definitely mentioned. It was when the rule was being discussed, they said that this would be a lifesaver for students who have been going through the emotional stress of tragedies like the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. And it's basically based on some of the money that is going to pay for this was as a result of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. So it is pretty tied to it.
Valerie, what's your take on you know, this requirement and, you know, that is finally just now happening? Because even with Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, the conversation about mental health, that's been discussed for a long time.
Important that, you know, we recognize that it's awesome to see that this is a priority of the governor and the First Lady. We at Health Information Project, known as HIP, we were founded in 2009. So we've been doing comprehensive peer-to-peer health education in Miami's high schools for 10 years now. And so our goal is to empower teens to tackle these health crises. And as you know, and we've been talking about for years, mental health is so important. It's so great to see that mental health education is now a priority and that everyone's kind of catching up to what we've been doing for 10 years now.
What do you think, Valerie, what impact do you think it's going to have on reducing the stigma around mental health issues?
Well, I mean, definitely, first off, it, you know, should never be taboo to talk about how you're feeling. And, you know, it's important to know that, you know, these emotionally and physically well students will also do better academically. So it's important to have these conversations. And what we've seen through our track record in Miami schools is that, you know, the peer-to-peer model is the way that students really respond and teenagers respond to being given an opportunity and a platform to talk about how they're feeling. So, you know, I only see it as a positive, and it would be great to see, you know, eventually how this is implemented in Florida schools.
See, this is interesting. So you focus on this peer-to-peer, having students being able to talk to each other. How then do you, you know, bring in a counselor? Because you have to have a professional at some point.
Absolutely. So what we do is we train 11th and 12th graders in the high schools to serve as peer health educators, and they talk to their ninth grade peers, a curriculum that we've created with our medical experts. But we've seen is it's so important not just to provide the education, but to connect to resources. And obviously our school counselors, they're the first ones, the adults to go to at the schools. If a school has a nurse or a clinic or a social worker, those are also amazing, great resources. So if our schools have those resources, we want to connect them to those resources so that students know who their school counselor is, where they are, and how they can get to them. And if those resources aren't at their school or they are dealing with something over a weekend or out of school hours, we also connect them to resources in the community.
So, Anna, coming back to you, understanding how this new requirement works, what is it going to be? Every school is going to have a counselor? Is it per district? I mean, what do they expect? How do they expect this to work?
Well, remember, this is more, it's required instruction. So this mental and emotional health was always a requirement, but they never really established the minimum hours that they should be teaching students every year. And now they have, and now it's at least five hours. And so that's going to be from 6 to 12. And it's, you know, it just depends, because it is a school district based decision. It's at the local level. It will depend on each school district to determine how they will be choosing, who the teachers will be, if it's going to be counselors, if it's what type of classes they will be. But they are only establishing the 5 minimum requirements.
So it could be a separate class. It could be one time thing. Everybody gets their 5 hours in, maybe over a day, or they bring in counselors. I mean, it could be anything then.
Right. They're leaving it pretty open. I think verbatim they said, you know, the decisions about which courses will be used will be on this instruction will be determined at the school district level. So they're really mandating the 5 hour minimum. They're making sure that there is some time set aside for this type of instruction. And it's up to the school district as to how they see it.
Did they ever bring up any kind of program similar to this anywhere that you could say, well, here's the basis on how we could do this?
That's a good question. I don't think they have, but they do have a list in statute as to which courses they can choose from. And, you know, it just depends on who the qualified instructors are at schools that might be more qualified to be teaching those sorts of instruction. And, you know, it's a pretty wide range of things that they can be teaching. One of them was, you know, teaching how to find resources, or how to like do mental health, diagnose and find the symptoms of mental
right.
health illness.
So Valerie, let me ask you this, because I hear this and I start thinking, okay, how are they going to implement this? What's the best way to implement it? And then I started thinking, oh God, this almost sounds like when they try to teach sex ed when I was growing up, which is just a strange class they took aside and they made sure we all took it. We signed a thing and we took it and that was it. I don't know. How should this be implemented? What do you think is the ideal way to make sure that you're not just getting the 5 hours out of the way? Okay, we did it and that's it.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously I'm partial. I believe that our HIP program, the fact that it's sustainable and embedded within the schools and is utilizing the students at the schools. We know that the peer-to-peer model works in a variety of things, and we've kind of revolutionized health education when it comes to that. We know that students want to listen to their peers, to feel that they're less alone, to have these conversations. And so we're proud of the fact that we've had this amazing partnership with Superintendent Carvalho and the Miami-Dade County Public Schools, as well as independent private schools, Gulliver, Ransom, and Riviera,
and
Valerie,
kind
of showing that this is the model that works.
Can you give me an example, by the way, of like, you know, any specific issue with mental health, a particular topic, and how you would do it, how it works? I want to get into a sense of what works.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I would say across, you know, the county, which I'm sure is similar in the state and across the rest of the nation, that, you know, anxiety, depression, stress are, you know, big topics in mental health that, you know, need to be discussed. So we train our peer health educators in everything from public speaking, classroom management, curriculum knowledge, how to have these conversations, and then how to connect these students to resources. So I'm proud to say that every ninth grader in the Miami-Dade County Public School, as well as our 34,000, as well as our independent private schools, 34,000 ninth graders have received our program this year at 58 high schools.
You know, Anna, coming back to you, as you said, the First Lady, Mrs. DeSantis, is the big proponent behind this. But what role is she going to be playing beyond this, beyond promoting it? What else did she say she was going to be doing?
Well, mental health has been a pretty big focus of hers. She's been taking a pretty active role with some policy changes in the area of mental health with her initiative, Hope for Healing. And, you know, she's been holding a lot of listening sessions across the state regarding how to help, you know, students and children with mental health issues. So it will be interesting to see what else she comes up with. But for now, you know, she's saying that, you know, she's hearing from people across the state that, you know, mental illness is a big priority for or concern of families. And she's definitely, you know, making some changes in that area, at least in the curriculum at school districts.
We're talking with Anna Ceballos, reporter for the News Service of Florida, and also joined by Valerie Barron. She's the operations director for the mental health nonprofit HIP, which is currently providing peer-to-peer mental health counseling in schools across Miami-Dade County. We're discussing this new requirement passed by the State Board of Education here in Florida, requiring at least 5 hours of mental health instruction for all 6th through 12th graders. And so what we're looking for is an answer as to what that instruction is going to look like, but that hasn't been determined yet. Valerie, there's a critical component to mental health education that we have to discuss as well. There have been studies about how the media and schools approach the issue of suicide, which can actually have adverse effects on students' mental health. Talk briefly about the do's and don'ts of mental health education that have to be followed so that the requirement doesn't do more harm than good.
Right. Well, I mean, I would definitely say, you know, it's important to have these conversations, to not ignore things, to not sweep things under the rug. I think that students who are suffering, we don't want them to suffer in silence. So we want them to know that there are resources out there, adults at the schools who can help them, counselors, nurses, clinics. And so we want to make sure we connect them to those resources. So obviously, yes, there's a lot in the media to see, but the studies, you know, are varied, but it's from our perspective, it's really important. And our medical advisory board as well, you know, says it's important to have these conversations and for kids to know that they're not alone. And if we ignore it, that's when, you know, things can happen that are unfortunate.
And the other thing too is that this begins in sixth grade. Why is that the best time to start?
I mean, I think what we're seeing, you know, middle school, high school age, there's a lot going on, you know, things with social media and, you know, a lot of things with stress, with a variety of things, family issues, school issues, friend issues. And it's just important to have these conversations at all of these ages and start it when you can.
And 5 hours, minimum 5 hours of instruction. I mean, is that enough?
I mean, I think mental health, you know, you can't talk about nutrition without mental health. You can't talk about drugs without mental health. So, you know, I feel like mental health is kind of the umbrella to a lot of things that are going on among, you know, kids, teenagers, adolescents. So, you know, I would always say, you know, it's better to have more and it's better to have something than not have anything at all.
Anna, I mean, you kind of touched on it a moment ago, but I just, again, how did the did state educators come to that number, 5 hours?
Well, I wouldn't know that, but I do know that, for example, some of the things that they have mentioned is that they had the requirement and they want to prioritize giving a minimum amount of time. And they, you know, I've asked them because I was curious about why the 5 hours and if it was going to take away from any other requirements of, you know, you only have a certain amount of time during a day or during a year for a school year. And I was wondering if it was going to take away from any other requirements, maybe like chipping away like half an hour away. And they haven't been able to tell me that. But I really don't. I don't know why the 5 hours, but this is just a sign of them prioritizing.
Right. What about
this type of instruction?
What have you heard from Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran, Anna, about his vision for this program? What does he expect?
Well, you know, he was pretty. He said that it was going to be a game changer and that it was just a beginning, and it kind of hinted to more coming on that specific front. You know, during session, we saw a lot of concern with this specific issue when two students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas committed suicide or died by suicide. And I know that, for example, this mental health instruction does include instruction on suicide prevention. And so that could potentially help students who are dealing with these sorts of trauma, and you know, it might be another way of getting into that school safety and school just more awareness about mental health issues and tying it to school safety.
Valerie, from your experience, what do you hear from parents about what they want to see in mental health programming in schools? What do they expect?
Well, I mean, I think what you see is parents, you know, are struggling to have these conversations with their kids sometimes. And so they're looking for, you know, schools or programs to be able to do that. And what they're also seeing is that, you know, their kids are not listening to them because they're adults, they're old, you know. So, you know, I think everyone wants to have these conversations and they just haven't yet figured out how to go about doing it. So I think, you know, parents like our students are sponges for information. And so we look at it as we're providing that support and that education in an accessible and sustainable way so that every student is getting it.
You do this peer to peer because you want the student to feel comfortable. So you have them really talk a lot with someone their own age. But at what point, how do you involve the parents?
So the parents, you know about our organization, have been supportive of it. You know, we work with the school about, you know, what it is that they need for parents. But our focus is on the students in the schools and this peer-to-peer model.
Anna, when do the new requirements go into effect?
They are saying that the rule will be in effect for the 2019-20 school year. So, you know, as soon as August when school starts.
Oh, so coming right up.
Right. Yeah, they made it clear that it was going to be for this upcoming school year. And so it's going to be interesting to see any decisions by school districts to see how they're going to be implementing this. I know that there's some procedures that the department wants to put in for school districts to document the planning and delivery of this instruction. But it will be interesting to see more of the details as to how this is executed.
I mean, do we know if school districts are now hiring more counselors?
Well, you know, there's $75 million that was allocated at the state for all school districts for mental health. So there's new requirements, too, under the Marjorie Sloman Douglas regarding, you know, counselors and, you know, school safety and all that package for keeping students more, you know, safe and healthy. And so I don't know. I mean, time will tell. We'll see once the school year starts how things are being executed.
This is interesting, too, is that, look, in the past year, a couple of years, because of what happened in Parkland, schools now have to think about security differently. And they've been having a hard time adjusting and making sure they can pay for the security and make sure it's there. Now they've got to add this. And you said it a second ago. It's like, well, how is that all going to, you know, get mixed into the day to day for a school? What do top educators, what do people in the state say about that?
Well, I think there has been some concern from at least the teachers union. They keep saying that, you know, that it's really not enough money for them to actually be able to meet all these requirements. But, you know, the state legislature certainly seems to think that they're providing what is necessary for them to be able to implement those changes. So it just depends on who you ask.
Yeah, just wait and see as each district has to make its own decisions because, as you said, it's going to be a district-by-district decision. Valerie, is your group going to be working with the Department of Education in monitoring this implementation of this? How do you foresee all of this playing out?
I mean, well, we're as an organization, you know, ready to take this model beyond Miami, whether it be the rest of the state, the rest of the country. So we'd be happy to have conversations with the Department of Education. We're not currently on their radar, but it would be definitely something we'd be open to in helping them implement this.
Again, talking with Valerie Barron, Operations Director for the mental health nonprofit HIP, currently providing peer-to-peer mental health counseling in schools across Miami-Dade County. We also were talking with Anna Ceballos, reporter for the News Service of Florida. Anna, Valerie, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can always find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. If you're a parent, love to hear your thoughts. What do you think your school district should do in implementing these requirements? What should they be teaching your kids about mental health issues? Well, still to come, we're going to learn about a former Miami race car driver who was also a major marijuana smuggler. He's at the center of a new Miami Herald podcast. It's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The Miami Herald has a new podcast. It's called Smoked. It follows a man named Randy Lanier, a well-known champion race car driver in the 1980s.
And there in car number 12 is Randy Lanier. He will start this race in the center of the second row.
He seems like he really, really enjoys being here.
I think it's an understatement to say that Randy enjoys everything now that he's not behind bars.
Beautiful day. Great day to be at a racetrack.
Because Randy Lanier might also be one of the biggest pot kingpins in American history.
Lanier was busted in 1987 as one of the most notorious marijuana smugglers in South Florida. He served 27 years in federal prison. Smoked explores Randy's story as well as Florida's changing relationship with marijuana. We're joined now by Miami Herald editor Amy Driscoll and Miami Herald reporter Alex Harris, both co-hosting this podcast. They're joining us from the studios of WLRN at the Miami Herald in Doral. Amy, Alex, always a pleasure.
Hi, Lewis.
All right, so this story begins in the 1980s. You know, we've all heard the stories of Miami's cocaine cowboys, but pot smuggling was huge as well back then. Amy, take us there. Tell us, remind us about that aspect of things.
Well, Florida has a long and storied history with smuggling. We all know that, those of us who live here. It goes back to the days of the rum runners. And in the late 70s and early 80s, a lot of it was pot. You know, the coastline makes it an ideal place for people who want to hide from the police. And that was in the days before, you know, we had Homeland Security and ICE. So people were able to land boats a lot easier than they are now. There was very little radar. They could kind of come and go in the night, and it was very hard to catch them. So a lot of people saw the opportunity there. And the person that we spent most of our time with on this podcast is Randy Lanier, this race car driver. He was also a pot smuggler, and he grew up in this area, came in as a kid in Broward County, and he saw an opportunity like a lot of people in that era.
You know what? I want to know a little bit more about him. This is fascinating. And I mean, growing up in South Florida, I didn't even know about this guy. Granted, I didn't follow auto racing, but you know, how he came up and became what he became and then was brought down. But real quickly, tell me, Amy and Alex, I want to hear from you, your thoughts on and who he is in his history, his importance to everything he did in this area. Also, how did you find this guy?
So Randy Lanier is in some ways one of a million.
All right, hold on a second, Alex. We're having some issues with your microphone. So Amy, let me jump to you and we'll get that fixed.
Okay, yeah. So Randy Lanier was a creature of his era, but there were a lot of people like him. We talked to a lot of different smugglers who made, you know, quite a bit of money back in the day. A lot of them went to prison, too. He came to our attention. He's been written about by a few other organizations. And what we really wanted to do was tell the story of Florida's history with marijuana, because in a lot of ways it embodies the change that we've seen in this whole country. We went from, you know, the era of just say no to legalization, dispensaries, marijuana as medicine. So for Randy, you know, he was there in those days when you could really just like take a boat to the Bahamas or Jamaica, load up with pot and come back, you know, to the coastline and come in at night, and probably you wouldn't get caught.
Yeah. Alex, I think we got it settled. Hopefully you got it fixed. Are you there? No, it sounds like you might, the microphone, we're going to get that fixed. Doesn't sound like I have you there. Maybe I'll just have you sit and share mics with Amy for a second.
Sure.
Amy, you know, in his prime, how good was Randy? You know, I mean, he kind of helped make racing big here.
Yeah, he burst onto the racing scene, really. But he started out kind of small in the SCCA, which is the Sports Car Club of America. And that's kind of a place where people cut their racing teeth. And he went from that into kart racing and eventually the Indy 500, where he was Rookie of the Year in 1986, which was a really big deal. It kind of marked you for stardom. But, of course, you know, as we now know, a lot of the money that it requires to be a really good racer comes from smuggling in his case.
Yeah, this is interesting. So anybody, even if you don't know racing, is the fact that You know, you need sponsors, and that's why you see all those little stickers all over cars, all these sponsors to pay for racing. Randy didn't have any of that. He was paying for this through his drug smuggling. Alex, how is he doing that? And how much money was he making?
He was making a ton of money. I think prosecutors have never actually nailed down the exact amount, but they did say in the indictment that he made at least $60 million over the course of the couple years he was running this ring. But yeah, it was tough to handle, you know, having a daughter, a young daughter, a young son, and a wife, also being this champion race car driver who was in the spotlight and craving that spotlight while balancing a career that depended on him not being in that spotlight. And sometimes they did, you know, end up crashing into each other. There was, we tell a story in the podcast of one time where he was supposed to be at this big race in Atlanta, but he had to miss it because he was in California waiting for a barge load of pot to come in.
That's the aspect of the story that is probably the most fascinating. Alex, how did he balance it? What did he say about how he tried to balance being a family man, being a race car driver, and being a drug smuggler?
So he kind of managed to keep it really all under wraps right up until everything fell apart in 1986-1987. He spent a lot of that racing money, that drug money, on his racing career, but he also spent a lot of it on his family. We talked to his daughter, Brandy, and she remembers her fifth birthday party. Her dad rented an elephant from Zoo Miami to come to her birthday party, Jessica the elephant. And so she remembers, you know, big times. They had a great house. They went on lavish European vacations. He had a private jet. In hindsight, it looks like it was pretty obvious that he had a lot of money come from somewhere other than racing. But back then, I guess it didn't really appear that obvious.
You know, going back to what you were saying about some of the different ways that pot was being smuggled into the United States, you know, for Randy, was there a particular system that he had? How was he doing it?
Well, he started out small, like a lot of people, with, you know, his own smaller boat coming in from the Bahamas or Jamaica. But pretty quickly, he realized that, you know, doing it in larger quantities would make him a lot more money, and, you know, he wouldn't have to do it quite as much. So he hit on this method that is pretty audacious. He bought a barge along with his partners, and the barge has these areas where, you know, the ballast is. They're huge, a football field length. And he opened those up and had secret compartments installed where he put all the marijuana that they were loading up in Colombia. And then sealed it back up, like with welders, so it was, you know, not obvious. They had a special system where if someone came and tested, which occasionally that happened in those days, to see what was down there, they would stick a pole down. That's how they would test, to see if it hit anything funny. So they would only build the compartments in the places where the pole couldn't hit. So they would get it to one of the big ports in the United States, in California or in New York, or New Orleans, and then they would hire people to, you know, cut it open, and then they would cart that stuff directly into semis. The semi trucks would be driven to stash houses, and they would distribute it across the country, often hiding it in refrigerated trucks with, like, you know, produce and stuff in there.
So I'm wondering if either of you were able to find this and hear from anybody on this, but again, if you're a race car driver, you're in the business, and you see somebody, you see a team winning, and then you look at their car and you don't see sponsors or you don't see that many, you have to ask yourself, how are they doing? Does anybody ever raise the question, how is this guy doing this?
Absolutely. Yeah, we actually talked to Jim Busby, who was a former race car driver in the same circuit that Randy raced in, which was IMSA. And Jim Busby said, yeah, everybody kind of talked about it. They looked at those cars that Randy drove or some other notorious drug smuggler and race car drivers, including the Whittington brothers. They looked at the lack of sponsorship on their cars and the beautiful brand new engines they had, the unlimited amount of tires they'd have ready to go. And they started to ask questions. And we also talked to a former Associated Press race car reporter at the time, Mike Harris, and he was fantastic. He talked to us a lot about, you know, yes, people were asking these questions, but it was never quite enough you could write a story about. There's never the proof, but it was definitely something people noticed and paid attention to.
We're talking with Miami Herald reporter Alex Harris, also Miami Herald editor Amy Driscoll. They are both behind the new Miami Herald podcast, Smoked. It is the story of former race car driver and marijuana smuggler Randy Lanier. You can find out more about it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So, Amy, Randy, again, his team, his race team was called Blue Thunder. They won a national championship at the International Motorsports Association Series in the first year. But when did those illegal activities finally start to catch up to him?
Well, it turns out that people were kind of investigating him along the way. It was also there were rumors about more than just him in the racing industry, in the racing business. There were a few other smugglers who were indicted or arrested along the way, including some of the people that he worked with. So he kind of knew he was being investigated, and eventually the noose kind of tightened around him. He was indicted in 86, but on sort of a tangential charge. He wasn't super involved in that case. And then again, he was indicted in 87, and that's when he decided to go on the run.
All right, so in 2014, he's released, spent 27 years behind bars, and then ironically, he's back in South Florida, and he's in racing again, but he's teaching. He's teaching racing at the Homestead Miami Speedway. Alex, what's his perspective on the fact that the weed business is so different today?
So, you know, you'd think about someone who spent nearly three decades in prison for smuggling marijuana would be kind of bitter, right? That the laws have changed so much, and now anyone can kind of walk around and get a job in a dispensary legally serving up weed to anyone who has a card. But Randy's not bitter. He is excited. It's something he's always thought should be legalized, and he totally admits that he was not out to, you know, he was not a legalization crusader when he was smuggling. He was doing this to make money. He wasn't doing this for the medical purposes, but he closely follows all the news coming up about the new medical discoveries and the states that are legalizing and decriminalizing it across the country, and he's very invested, and he considers himself an advocate for normalization and legalization of marijuana across the country.
So as you said, though, Alex, he was doing it because he for the money,
right.
For the racing, but did he ever envision a day when it wouldn't be illegal?
You know, we asked him that, and he sort of was a child of the 60s and 70s, right? They kind of at that point thought maybe weed would be legal soon. They thought that the day was coming, and when it didn't happen and he went to prison and ended up following his life down that path, I think the hope kind of died. But while he was in prison those 27 years is when the legalization efforts ramped up. It was 96, was California was the first to legalize medical marijuana. And he, you know, was there every step of the way. Every time a law changed, he said it gave him hope. Every time he saw, you know, a new march on Washington or a new bill passed or a law changed. And by the time, you know, by the mid-90s, early 2000s, he was positive it was going to be legalized one day.
You know, Amy, another irony to this is that his daughter, Randy's daughter, works at a dispensary in Colorado. How does she feel knowing that she's dealing with a substance that put her father behind bars all those years?
Well, she is certainly an advocate for legalization. But she also says that, you know, yes, her father probably influenced her to a certain degree, but she really didn't think about it too much until he was out and they were, you know, talking and she realized that there was a business opportunity there. So in some ways, she's kind of like her dad. She's an entrepreneur, too. She sees an opportunity there. But she tells us a funny story that her father called her from prison when medical marijuana, or actually marijuana was legalized, period, in Colorado. And called her and said, you know, can you believe this is happening? And she said, I kind of was afraid to tell him that I didn't even vote. and she said, they laugh about it now. But she said she knows she should have voted. And she, in retrospect, realizes that, you know, that would have been a positive thing for her father. But to make her own living in it today is certainly something that's not lost on both of them.
Randy's 64 now. What is his future? What does he see for himself?
So right now, he kind of, you know, he lives a much quieter life, obviously, after finishing his parole and everything. He lives in Davie. He teaches race car driving on the weekends when he has the when he can. And the rest of his days, he spends working as a behavioral technician in a rehab clinic. And he spends a lot of time with his grandkids. He does a lot of meditation on sunrises at the beach. He lives a really, you know, chill life now. And he says he really enjoys just spending a lot of time with his family.
And real briefly from both of you, Alex, I'll start with you. I mean, you both work in print, in newspapers, but you know, this, I believe, is your first hit on a podcast. How is it different for you in telling stories this way?
Oh, it's totally different. It's a different part of your brain. But it was a really wonderful form of storytelling because you get to actually hear the emotion in people's voices when you use a quote rather than just boiling it down to text on a page. That's been my favorite part, is being able to convey a lot more in someone's quote through audio.
And Amy, how about for you?
Yeah, there's no filter in a podcast. The people who are listening to it hear it directly. They can hear how the person sounds and what they're really, you know, if there is emotion in their voices. And that's a kind of freeing way to convey a story, I think.
Amy Driscoll is the editor, an editor for the Miami Herald, and Alex Harris, a reporter for the Miami Herald. Both of them worked on their new podcast. It's called Smoked. Again, the story of a former race car driver and marijuana smuggler, Randy Lanier. Find out more on our social media at WLRN Sandal. It really was a lot of fun. Amy, Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis.
And that's our program for this Tuesday, July 23rd. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandra Martinez. Our intern is Sherilyn Cabrera. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director and the man pushing all the buttons today is Jason Zabka. Well, tomorrow, in place of Sundial, we're going to bring you coverage of former special counsel Robert Mueller's testimony before Congress. It's live from NPR. It'll focus on Mueller's report on Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. The coverage begins at 8:30 tomorrow morning and will continue through the conclusion of the hearings. You can follow us online and on social media for updates. Sundial will be back with another live show on Thursday. Remember, find us on social media, WLRN Sundial. We always love to hear from you, your thoughts on the program. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you again on Thursday.